south of the border, down Mexico way. That's where I fell in love when the stars above came out to play. And now as I wander...
Hello there, all you expat wannabes. I'm Johnny Mueller, and you're listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, the show that tells you just what it's like to live, work, play, and or retire down here in Latin America. It's a mix of the good, the bad, the ugly, and the great, and it's all right here, so let's get started.
You know, every time I talk about how cheap labor is down here in Latin America, when I mention that your cleaning lady or gardener makes 12 to 15, maybe 18 bucks a day, not an hour, a day. And on the gringo tourist trail, maybe 20 or 25. That is, if they're working for gringos and expats, not locals. It seems every time I mention that, I get a couple of emails from people saying, that's just terrible, Johnny. Why do you promote that? Those poor people, all those businesses down in Latin America, taking advantage, including all those transnational companies and gringos and expats who hire the locals, are just perpetuating that poverty. By the way, speaking of transnational companies moving to Latin America, specifically in this case, Mexico, to take advantage of those lower labor prices, those vastly lower labor prices. Of course, everybody knows all the big car companies are down in Latin America, mostly in Mexico, Brazil, Argentina. Sure gutted Detroit, didn't it? But did you know that all the big U.S. and European truck manufacturers are down in Latin America too? Mostly Mexico, Argentina, and Brazil once again. For example, Freightliner, Kenilworth, Navistar, Hino International, Dina, Man SE, that's a German company, Mercedes-Benz, of course, Isuzu, Scania, Cummins, and Detroit Diesel are in Mexico. Yep, Detroit Diesel has the balls to continue to call itself Detroit Diesel when the majority of their trucks are made in Mexico. How about that for hypocrisy? Though, if you think about it, it does stand to reason that the big truck companies are now producing in Mexico. That way they can put the secret compartments in right at the source, right where the drugs are being processed. You think so? But back to the subject of accusing gringos and expats of going south of the border, south of the border sometimes, to take advantage of the poor people and their extremely low labor costs. Well, just like most issues, this one's much more complicated than you think. In fact, I got a little boots-on-the-ground story that just might give you an idea how complicated it really is. Seems one day, not so long ago, I got a call from a friend of mine who owns a couple of those maquilas. You know, sweatshops, as they're known in the U.S. media. But let me assure you, those big maquila factories, when they're located in Guatemala in the Altiplano, they're the farthest thing from the stereotypical sweatshop you can think of, because the weather is really nice in the Altiplano and they don't need air conditioning, so there's no sweating involved. So in those big factories, they keep the windows open and the fans going all the time. And because it's perfectly comfortable, they get a lot more production out of the workers. The secondary effect is everyone's happier, seems to be, as opposed to the maquilas and sweatshops in places like Jamaica or Honduras near the coast. Talk about sweat. You don't have to move a muscle to sweat in those places. But in the Altiplano, it's completely different. Yeah, you might think I'm just saying that, but you have to visit one of those places to see for yourself. In fact, with many of my expat insider seminars, we go right into one or two of those factories in Guatemala, those so-called sweatshops, and no one seems to be sweating at all. But anyway, not so long ago, I got a call from one of my buddies who owns three or four of those things. A longtime gringo expat, a Jewish guy, from New York, from the Garment District. By the way, I mentioned his Jewishness because he told me for a fact that about 95% of all the big clothing manufacturing factories, those so-called sweatshops throughout Latin America, are owned by two different kinds of people, New York Jews and South Koreans. So then you might ask, why are there so many transplanted New York Jews owning maquilas here in Latin America? Well, because traditionally, the clothing business in the USA, which is the biggest in the world, right, came out of the Garment District in New York, mostly historically owned by Jews. So when the Asian and Indian competition started horning in on their territory, they started expanding their maquilas to Central and South America and the Caribbean, too. They had to survive, to be more competitive. You know that story. It started with Clinton signing those free trade agreements. You know that big sucking sound third-party candidate Ross Perot was always talking about? It was Clinton who got that ball rolling on steroids. So anyway, the major owners of all the maquilas here in Central and South America, by a huge margin, have been South Koreans and Jewish garment district guys from New York. So anyway, one day I get a call from one of my garment factory owner friends. He says, "What are you doing Sunday?" I said, "I don't know. What do you got in mind?" He said, "Well, since you were an engineer in your past life," he said, "why don't you come out with me on Sunday? You're going to find this really interesting." I said, "Okay." Sunday came. He picked me up. We drove out to a big free trade zone in Guatemala, to a maquila area. We pulled up to one that had Korean letters across the door. How did I know they were Korean? He told me. Personally, I don't know Korean from Japanese, from Chinese when looking at the letters. Do you? So anyway, two Korean guys let us in. The place was just filled with all kinds of different machines that manufactured clothing. Old ones, new ones, crazy-looking Rube Goldberg ones. Probably 50, maybe 75 different machines and stations for people to work. But there were no workers, just me, my friend, and the two Korean guys. Well, those two Korean guys started talking to my buddy in really bad Spanish. I understood most of it. But man, I'll tell you, it was worse than mine. And every once in a while, we'd stop at a machine and they'd switch it on. It would do some kind of operation, like turn out the stitching on a belt, make a hat band, put some glitter on a t-shirt, fasten a zipper or some studs to a pair of jeans, turn out little foam discs for shoulder pads. Seems like every one of those machines had a different specific purpose. Yep, it was a real interesting experience, all right. I'd say about 3/4 of them were one-offs. In other words, they were custom-made. Not something you could order out of a catalog. That means, and my buddy verified this, an engineer, a materials guy, and a machinist had to get together with someone who really knew the garment business to come up with some of these things. Anyway, after that little factory tour was over, my buddy told me he bought all those machines from those two Korean guys. He said he'd made the deal a couple of days earlier, but just needed a show and tell. Then I said the logical thing, you must be expanding, right? He said, "Nope, I'm just going to store those things in one of my warehouses." I said, "Are you going to sell them?" He said, "No, I'm going to hold on to them." I said, "Really?" He said, "Yes, because once in a while, you get a weird order from someone out of New York. They need to fulfill a certain kind of order right away. Maybe it's a special kind of glitter or spangle on a t-shirt, custom buckles, buttons, metal studs." He said, "If you don't have a machine on hand to do that, you lose the order. If you don't have the right machine, it takes time to put one together. You have to either modify something that you have or build a brand new one. So instead of getting the job done in 45 days, you can do it in 15. He said, "Fashions change seasonally, and it's all about timing. So you offer the best turnaround time, you get the job." I thought, yep, that's right. It's logical. Every day you learn something, right? So that was that. It wasn't your typical day. Then, about 2 weeks later, on the second or third page of the Prensa Libre, the biggest newspaper in Guatemala, something very interesting caught my eye. By the way, if you're in Guatemala for any length of time, you'll know about the Prensa Libre. For a long time, I had a subscription to it. It's in Spanish, of course, 100% Spanish. It was one of the ways I fine-tuned my Spanish by reading the classified ads. Anyway, about 2 weeks later, I was flipping through the Prensa Libre, and I saw a photo of that very factory we'd visited with all those machines in it. There was a photo of the inside of the place. It was completely empty. No machines, not a single one. And there was a picture of the outside of the place, the front entrance, with about 500 people mulling around outside and cop cars there, too. Now, the article said, basically, 600 first-shift employees showed up for work on Monday morning to find that their jobs at the factory no longer existed. The factory no longer existed. The doors were locked, the windows boarded, and the Korean owners were nowhere to be found. So I called up my buddy. "What the hell's going on?" I said. "You see the paper today? The article about your Korean buddies?" He said, "They're long gone. They're in Vietnam now, setting up shop." He said they made plans to do that a couple of months ago after the Guatemala president and Congress voted to increase the minimum wage by about $1 a day. So instead of the factory workers making, I think back then, $12 a day, they were making 13 now. And that was enough to push those two Korean guys over the edge. They set up in Vietnam where they only pay $7 a day. My buddy said, "I'm not shocked. I'm not surprised. That's how the maquila business works." He said almost no one ever owns their factory. They just rent in a free trade zone, a zona franca. So it's easy to just liquidate your equipment and pick up and leave. He said dickhead politicians who want to get elected or reelected are always threatening to raise the minimum wage. They almost never do, but this time they did. In fact, politicians harp on it all the time. It's a surefire way to get the masses to vote for you. Now, you might think Guatemala's minimum wage is rather low, but there are lots of other countries much lower than that, like Vietnam. In fact, another one of my Bakila buddies, not an owner but an administrator, a Jewish guy too, working in the family business. I think it was his cousin or uncle that owned the business. Anyway, one day he called me up and said, "You want to buy my car? I'll sell it really cheap." I said, "How cheap?" He said, "How about a half of Blue Book?" I said, "I'll come over and have a look." And guess what? I went to his apartment in a really nice area of Zone 10 in Guatemala City. Those guys really lived nice, high on the hog. I walked in and the place was half empty. He had everything boxed and packaged and said, "Do you want to buy a dining room table and chairs? How about a 55-inch flat-screen TV?" I said, wait a minute. What's going on?" He said, "We're shutting down the maquilas in Guatemala." He said his uncle or cousin, I can't remember which one, is moving the operation to Vietnam. Where'd I hear that before? "And I'm going to run the operation. I don't want to go there," he said, "but the money's too good to pass up. And they're closing up shop within the next couple of months. And as much as I like, even love Guatemala, I'm too young to retire and I got to do something." And then we sat down and had a few drinks, or I should say he had a few drinks, and he almost shed a tear. And I thought, wow, this guy really loves Guatemala. He really doesn't want to leave. And when I mentioned that to him, he said, "I'm not choking up because of that. I'm choking up because, you see, my brother was in the Vietnam War and got killed by the North Vietnamese. And now I'm going back to the scene of the crime to start up a business. I'm going to be hanging with those guys." He said, "I'm having a hard time dealing with that." So anyway, the point of this little rant is that every third world country, and every first world country too, has a minimum wage. And it's arbitrarily or somewhat arbitrarily determined by corrupt governments. Are there any other kind? And it's used as a political tool to get pustulant asswipes elected and reelected. The fact is, if you ask anyone making minimum wage in a third world country, they'll tell you they absolutely hate their government, they ought to be all fired and or put in jail. But when election time comes around and they see that politicians promise goodies, freebies, they still believe they all should be shot or put in jail, but they'll vote for the guy who promises to raise the minimum wage every time. They never, ever think about the secondary or tertiary effects. Like, for example, employers might not be able to afford that, so they're going to lay off people instead, or close down, or leave for greener, cheaper pastures. People don't want to hear about that. But our story's still incomplete. Are you wondering why those Korean guys just up and left? Sold their equipment and never gave their employees a heads up that they were closing down. Not even on Saturday, the very last working day of the week. Yep, that's right. You probably know already. Here in Latin America, people work on Saturdays. Because, you know, in Latin America, almost everyone, especially the minimum wage workers, work a half day on Saturday. Did you know that down here, it's not a 40-hour, but a 44-hour work week? An important point to remember if you ever hire a local. Anyway, those two Korean maquila owners were clever. They were playing a little game that lots of factory owners play. If a company's got to go out of business for whatever reason, or stay intact by doing business elsewhere and leaving the country you're in, the sneaky way is to tell no one. Just do business as usual till the day you close your doors. And on Sunday, just pack everything up and leave. Get the hell out of the country. When Monday morning comes and the workers show up, let them discover in that moment that they no longer have a job. I know, it's a very unjust and cowardly move, but they do it for a reason. Because all governments, even third world governments, have labor laws. And when you close down a factory, for example, in Guatemala, or any place in Latin America, you have to pay your employees indemnization, which can, in some cases, depending on how long an employee has been working there, can be a year's severance pay. So just imagine if you've got 600 workers and you're closing up shop, some of them might be due a couple of months' severance, but some would be due a year's severance pay. And here's how the law works. If you close up shop and you can't pay severance to everyone, the government locks up the owner's assets. That would mean the building. Remember, though, most maquila owners just rent their space, so that won't apply. But then there's the equipment. They'll impound that. But often, as it turns out on those fateful Monday mornings when things like this do go down, when the cops finally get the doors open, there's often nothing left, not even the toilets or the bathroom sinks. So there you have it, just a little reality check for all you doogers out there who continually beat up on third world countries for having such a low minimum wage. Just remember, those minimum wage jobs are very fluid. And companies, especially transnational companies, are always looking to cut the bottom line. Now, if you're lamenting the loss of production jobs and manufacturing facilities in the States, that's exactly what happened to the U.S. auto, steel, and heavy industry. We all know that story all too well. You know, they say, be careful what you wish for. In this case, be careful who you shame. By the way, speaking of scams and strange things going down in Latin America, I was visiting one of my Latin American buddies. He lives in an upper middle class neighborhood, which is solidly middle class in the States. It's a nice, peaceful neighborhood called the Colony down here, or Colonia, with decent 3- and 4-bedroom houses, big yards, gated, guarded community. Almost all the property owners, businessmen, professionals, and scumbag politicians, you know. The usual mix of people who actually work for a living and the assorted government slug. The salaries for the folks in that neighborhood are people making from $25,000 to maybe $45,000 a year. You know, that's upper middle class here in Latin America. But if you make that kind of money up where you and I come from, you wouldn't own, you'd rent. On the wrong side of the tracks, too. But I digress. Anyway, I was at my Latino buddy's house visiting about a year ago, and we were sitting out on the front porch, I think it was a Saturday afternoon, and suddenly we heard some racket. People were screaming at each other. A fight had broken out in the house next door. Sort of a yelling match, a couple screaming at each other for who knows what. I said to my buddy, it sounds like the neighbors are on the warpath. What's up with that? He said, yep, they're at it again. I don't know. They fight like that at least once a week. He said, I've talked to the guy a couple of times. Seems like a decent type. He's a lawyer, but no class. He said, I'm thinking someday it's going to escalate. One of them's going to kill the other one, and the cops will be there, and it'll be the end. He said, I really hope they move out before it gets that bad. But so far, he said, no such luck. Then my friend said, looking at the two nice cars parked in the driveway, he said, you know how he makes his money? He's a loan shark. I said, a lawyer loan shark? How's that work? He said, being a lawyer, you get a higher class of people borrowing money from you. They have better jobs, they're more stable, and are more likely to pay you back on time. I thought about that for a second and said, yeah, makes sense. Then I said to my buddy, so being a lawyer loan shark, that's legal, huh? He said, probably not, but, you know, they don't enforce things like that down here. There's a loan shark or two in every neighborhood. Everyone knows who they are, and the cops don't do a thing about it. In some neighborhoods, the cops are their best customers. My buddy said that lawyer just happened to be a loan shark for a higher caliber of customer. Then I asked, what's his interest rate? He said he gets 40% a month. I thought to myself, no wonder he's got such nice new cars. And all his money's tax-free, too. That's about 500% interest a year. Wow, who wouldn't want a piece of that? Then I said, if they don't pay, I'm thinking he's not in the business of breaking people's legs. How's a guy like that put the pressure on? It seemed to me a guy like that's too high profile to get really tough with people. So I wonder how he gets deadbeats to pay. My buddy said he collects all right. He doesn't have to worry about not getting paid. Guys like him use a different kind of system than the loan sharks on the street. Think about this. His clients, they're all working on the books and get paid by a direct deposit twice a month in their bank accounts that are attached to a debit card. I said, wait a minute, unconfuse me. Explain that again. He said the lawyer will only make a loan to a person who's working a full-time job and getting paid by direct deposit through a local bank that has a debit card attached to the account. Then I thought, yeah, that makes sense. That's how all bank accounts work down here. You open a bank account, they give you a debit card. That's automatic. It happened to me when I opened a bank account. And if you get a direct deposit from a company you work for, or if you're on a pension, or you're a gringo, for example, who gets Social Security, the way most everyone down here gets their money out is to go to an ATM and use that debit card. Then my buddy said, here's how the lawyer is guaranteed to get paid on those loans. Let's say a working class guy comes to him and wants to borrow $1,000. He loans him the $1,000, 40% a month, and he takes the guy's debit card as collateral, and he gets the PIN number from him too. And at the end of the month, he texts the guy who owes him and says, Do you want to pay the interest or the interest and some of the balance? Or maybe even all the balance? Then the lawyer takes that debit card, goes to the ATM, and pulls that amount. Now, when he said that, I had to think about that for a while. I thought, you mean people give up their debit card and their PIN number? Isn't that awful risky? Yeah, I guess it is. But if you're desperate enough for dough that you'll pay 40% interest a month, I guess anything goes. Besides the fact that when the guy takes out a loan like that, he's desperately broke. That means he's got no dough in that bank account that's attached to the debit card. Anyway, not till his employer deposits his salary. It only gets topped off every 15 days when they get their paycheck. Remember that most everyone here in Latin America is now being paid by a direct deposit. That is, everyone who's working on the books. So the fact is, like up in the States, almost no one down here in Latin America uses checks anymore. Unless you're in the informal economy selling stuff on the street, it's all direct deposit. Anyway, sounds pretty crazy to me, but that's how loan sharks are working things these days. They get your debit card and your PIN number, and they take their dough right out of your account through an ATM. And then, if and when you pay off your debt, you get your credit card back. Obviously, you want to change your PIN number, which you can do at any ATM, right? By the way, that's not the end of the story with that couple next door having that scream fest. If you remember, all of this happened about a half a year ago when I was visiting my Latino buddy. Anyway, about a week ago, I stopped by my buddy's house again. We were sitting on the porch, admiring nature once again. And I noticed that the house next door, which was about 100 feet away, there was something definitely wrong. It seemed like every single window was broken or cracked. The yard was unkempt and the house looked abandoned. And I said to my buddy, "What the heck happened over there?" He said, "Johnny, you're not going to believe this." He said, "Remember last time you were here, they were having a scream fest, and I said I wish the hell they'd move out?" Well, my buddy said about 3 months ago, they had another big scream fest. She threw his clothes and everything out in the front yard. Apparently, he was cheating on her. He left. At least I never saw his car parked there again. Then, about 2 months later, that's about 1 month ago, she knocked on my door. She seemed a little bit drunk and out of it. I let her in. She started crying and told me the story of how her husband was cheating on her. She wasn't crying about that, she said. She was crying about the fact that about 2 days ago, two policemen and a guy from the bank came over to her house, knocked on the door, told her she had 3 days to vacate because the mortgage had not been paid on the house in 6 months. She said, "That can't be. The house is paid for." The banker said, "Not true," and pulled out a document, a second mortgage that was signed for $170,000. $170,000 in the local funny money, of course. The banker pointed to hers and her husband's signature on the document. So, piecing the story together, her husband forged her name on the document, took the money, and went to the United States with his new girlfriend. Well, the crazy wife just flipped out. She was irate. She said, "He forged my signature. I never signed it." And the guy from the bank said, "Well, the mortgage hasn't been paid in 6 months. We can't find him, but we found you. You're legally married to him, and your name's on the document. If you think he forged your name, you have to take that up with a judge. None of our business. You're 6 months in arrears. You have to get out in 3 days. We're taking possession." And as she was telling that story to the next-door neighbor, my buddy, she said something about living with the relatives out in the boonies somewhere, wherever that was. She had just 1 day left, and she had to leave. Then, my buddy said, that night, in the middle of the night, he heard windows cracking and breaking. Turns out she took a hammer and went around to every window in the house and broke it. She smashed up the walls, the plumbing, the woodwork, packed a bunch of junk into her car and took off. That was a couple of months ago, he said. And still, the bank hasn't got around to fixing the windows. They'll have to do that before the rainy season. Man, was he right about that. So, as of right now, my buddy said, they're both fugitives. From a civil case, a vandalism case with the bank. And the cops certainly aren't going to enforce that one. No one's going to be looking for her or him. Unless they kill each other, that's quite possible. The moral of that story is, well, I don't really know what the moral is, but I can tell you this. My buddy told me just a couple of days ago, his kid, who's around 19 years old, I guess, my Latino buddy's kid, thinks she's on the Latin Cupid dating site, using filters, of course, but he thinks he recognized her under a different name. Apparently, she's pretty hot, so she'll get some hits. So, it looks as though there just might be a sequel to this story. I'll keep you posted. In the end, there you have it. That Latin Cupid site rears its ugly head again. A refuge for scoundrels. All right, let's take an email. This is from Mr. JC. A great guy and an expat insider seminar alumnus. He says, "Johnny, a Latin American lawyer we know kicked ass
at the closing of our property in Antigua, Guatemala. Turns out, he said, we got the property at 80% off the listed price, just like we were told at the seminar. He says, anyway, Johnny, I was wondering if you've thought about the following scenario. In our case, we're using an Ecofiltro water filter. By the way, if you don't know what that is, it's a certain water filter that's been developed in Guatemala. It's won all kinds of international awards. A gravity feed filter. Highly recommended. You just put it on your countertop, throw in some tap water or even river water. It's a 3-in-1 ceramic filter, carbon filter, and it's impregnated with colloidal silver. Highly recommended, but they're kind of fragile. You know, they're made out of ceramic, so if you drop them or manhandle them too much, it'll break. Though perfect for drinking water one cup at a time. Anyway, he says, we're using an echo filter, though we probably don't need it where we currently live. But it's recommended that you change out the inner ceramic clay pot once a year. But why, he asks. It still drips just fine, and it's not like the nano silver impregnated layer can ever go bad. Though maybe the silver does oxidize somehow, thus reducing the effectiveness on the killing of bacteria. What are your thoughts on it, Johnny? By the way, JC's a brilliant engineer, and I'm sure he's thought about this more than most. Now, JC, if you remember, we went to the Ecofilter plant during the seminar, right? Now, I've taken that tour a number of times, and I remember that question being asked. And I recall the owner or one of the engineers said, if you're just using it in your house to filter tap water, the filter should easily last 3 years. However, if you're dumping river water or Coca-Cola or mud in it, it'll get pretty clogged up and run slow. That doesn't mean it's not doing its job. It just means you have to do a little maintenance, like taking out the inner pot and scrubbing it down a bit with one of those non-metallic scrubbing pads. Same thing you would do if you had a ceramic cartridge filter that gets clogged. You just pull it out and scrub it down. You know, get the surface color gunk and slime off of it. I think I'd do that once a year or maybe every 6 months, depending what kind of water you're filtering. But to answer your question, even if the insert on the package when you buy it says change the pot inside, the inner pot, once a year, I've heard it from the horse's mouth a number of times at the factory that 3 years is a good average lifespan. I've even heard people at the factory say they've got some running 5 years with no degradation in quality. Your call, though.
South of the border. You've been listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America. If you need some help with your own Plan B, we can schedule a one-on-one phone or Skype consult. Just send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. And if you want to get on the waiting list for my next week-long Expat Insider Seminar in Central America, where you're guaranteed to get a 2 to 5 year head start on your Plan B, send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. Nos vemos.